Hi, I'm Cleo, and this is the podcast in which I use my PhD in English to interpret the songs of Taylor Swift. Welcome to episode 4, Taylor Swift and Nostalgia. Taylor Swift is nostalgic, or maybe she is the cause of nostalgia, or maybe nostalgia is something that she does, that she uses, that she wields like a weapon. A Washington Post headline reads, "Taylor Swift's new take on Fearless piles on the nostalgia along with some revenge." The Michigan Daily trumpets that Fearless Taylor's version harnesses the power of nostalgia. The Atlantic suggests that the artist's first release from her re-recording project is much more than a nostalgia play, it's a love letter. NPR suggests that Fearless Taylor's version feels shrouded in an air of whimsical nostalgia. An article in the New York Times states that fans can simultaneously relive the music as nostalgia and consume it as a vicarious act of empowerment. Where in one place nostalgia seems to have power, in others it is separated, made distinct from empowerment. It's tied to whimsy, contrasted with love, connected to but not conflated with revenge. I don't think nostalgia is being misused or misunderstood in any of these headlines, but I don't think it's very easy to tell from them what nostalgia means and what it has to do with Taylor Swift. I'm going to do things differently this time, inevitably, because the past is behind us and we can never regain it no matter how hard we try to reproduce it exactly song by song. And yes, I'm looking at you here, Taylor Swift, as always. That is, this time, I'm not going to start by reading the lyrics. I'm going to talk about the theory first because I think we have this problem with nostalgia, which is that we don't know what it is. So, let's get into it. Nostalgia, like everything, has a history. In his book, What Nostalgia Was, War, Empire, and the Time of a Deadly Emotion, the historian Thomas Dodman follows nostalgia from the 17th century, when it was considered a treatable disease, through its transformation into a common emotion. Although, as Dodman writes, quote, "it may be impossible to disentangle what is transhistorical and what is historically specific about our propensity to long for and desire things lost or never quite possessed." And even here, nostalgia feels enshrouded in vagueness. What does it mean to long for things lost or never quite possessed? How can that be the same emotion, to yearn either for what you had or what you didn't have? Well, the theorist Susan Stewart suggests an answer when she calls nostalgia a sadness without an object. Because, as she puts it, the past nostalgia seeks has never existed except as narrative, and hence always absent. That past continually threatens to reproduce itself as a felt lack. In other words, nostalgia by definition is about what you never had, even when it takes the form of a story about something that you supposedly used to have. That thing you missed never existed, and nostalgia is the pain that goes along with knowing that. Anyway, as Dodman shows, nostalgia wasn't always the same thing. As he puts it, quote, "a particular kind of longing was laid bare at a given moment in time, deemed pathological for the next two centuries, only then to be progressively folded into the normal emotional economy of human beings." And in fact, the actual economy, because as Dodman argues, nostalgia is central to consumer culture, to the fashion industry, for example, into which nostalgia is built. Nostalgia feeds the onward rush of capitalism with the past, dragging past styles back into the economy. As Dodman puts it, nostalgia is, quote, "not just a product of the modern world, but a fundamentally constitutive part thereof, a subjective experience of time and space so adequate to the peculiar regimes of historicity of capitalism that it appears natural, as if it were a fundamental human trait." And remember, it is partly in relation to fashion that we discussed Taylor's nostalgia in our Simpler Days, episode 3. For Taylor, clothes keep coming back, force you to come back to them, help you come back from oblivion or disrepute. The knowledge that fashion will continue to go round and round, as well as the relatively short timeline of any trend, is an intrinsic part of the experience of caring about fashion. After all, knowing that a trend, no matter how cool it might seem now, is going to look pretty stupid in a year is the whole point. But don't worry, something new will be available for just $49.99 to replace the old. How bittersweet. As for cardigan, which we discussed last time, let's not forget that you could buy the cardigan on Taylor's website, or at least a version of it. not the actual cardigan in the song, which of course is only a metaphor for the cyclicality of fashion, of popularity, of fame and fortune, and of course of love, nor the one Taylor wears in promotional materials, but a reproduction. If in our last episode we read the cardigan as representing the essential belatedness of all human life that matter is capable of instantiating, I think we now have to revisit it as an instance of capitalism's drive to commodify the past, folding it into the present's emotional and capitalistic economy. Indeed, the theorist Frederick Jameson claims in Postmodernism, or The Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism, that his present, the late 80s and early 90s, was characterized by, quote, an omnipresent and indiscriminate appetite for dead styles and fashions, and that that appetite was inherent to what it meant to be postmodern. This might surprise you. It surprised me, as someone who was happy several years ago that 80s fashions were coming back because it meant I could wear huge glasses. The idea of the 80s as being in some way post-historical, a jumble of artifacts from different periods, was surprising. But then, Jameson also argues that the experience of living in a particular time, the 50s for example, is different from the construction of that time in retrospect, or even from an attempt to view one's own present nostalgically, to imagine what from the present might, from the vantage of the future, appear distinctive. After all, the 50s didn't exist until we invented them after they were over, and nor did the 80s, and we don't know how the 2020s will live in the historical imagination, except that it will probably have something to do with face masks. Anyway, for Dodman and Jameson, nostalgia is essentially tied to capitalism and globalism. Talking about nostalgia tends to lead to big statements about capitalism, about modernity and postmodernity, about history and historicity. But how can we use nostalgia as a way into the work of Taylor Swift? Well, I have one initial impulse. The theorist Svetlana Boehm discusses nostalgia's fundamental ambivalence, in that it is about the repetition of the unrepeatable, materialization of the immaterial. I think Taylor's use of the word haunted is a way of thinking through nostalgia's ambivalence. The speaker of Cardigan, Betty, says to James, "I knew you'd linger like a tattoo kiss. I knew you'd haunt all of my what-ifs. The smell of smoke would hang around this long, 'cause I knew everything when I was young." The incorporeality of the tattoo kiss, the haunting of the what-ifs, and the smell of smoke point to presence as absence, absence as presence. Unlike a cardigan, a kiss, and the word or thought what-if, and smoke and the smell of smoke, can't be easily commodified. Rather, they point to something a little harder to pin down, because it's invisible, or maybe because it's not there. The lover haunts the what-ifs, the possible or maybe impossible futures, just as his absence causes Betty to chase variously incorporeal forms from shadows to smoke. In the lyrics of Taylor's earlier song, Haunted, the speaker's lover and the speaker's breath seem irrevocably tied together. The speaker holds her breath, hoping that her lover will choose to stay, and when he leaves, he seems to take her breath with him. She can't breathe once he's gone. She says, "Oh, I'm holding my breath, won't see you again. Something keeps me holding on to nothing." The ghost is something between something and nothing. Breath, smoke, a kiss, a word. It is the trace of something gone that is, however, somehow still there. A thing that's not quite a thing. She's holding her breath, which is also nothing, which is also her absent lover. And in fact, even in the last episode, when we were talking about the things that the lover mails back and all too well, the most prominent thing is the absent scarf, which he retains because he can't get rid of it. Its absence speaks louder than the presence of the other things about the persistence of memory. And Taylor tends to do something really interesting, which is that her songs that seem the most attached to the past, that try to regain or relive a past relationship, are also the songs that are about knowing that that relationship is fragile or doomed. So in Cardigan, Betty talks about how she always knew how the relationship would go. "I knew I'd curse you for the longest time, chasing shadows in the grocery line," and so on. In Haunted, the speaker says, "You and I walk a fragile line, I have known it all this time. Never ever thought I'd see it break." I suggest that the line, here in both cases rhymed slantly with time, suggests one way of thinking about the passage of time. The speaker of style says, "I should just tell you to leave because I know exactly where it leads, but I watch it go round and round each time." Where in Haunted and Cardigan, time rhymed with line, here it rhymes with I, and I is repeated twice at the end of the line, a rhyme that goes round and round. Taylor also ends some lines in Cardigan with I. It's kind of a stylistic trait for her. It allows her to pause pause and seemed to gasp for breath after using the first-person pronoun, as though winded in the rush to tell her truths, or maybe as though realizing that she now has to say I where she used to say we. In some ways, knowing how it is going to go feels like almost an emotion for Taylor, an emotion that may be connected to, or a version of, or even the opposite, of nostalgia. Susan Stewart argues that, quote, the nostalgic dreams of a moment before knowledge and self-consciousness, that itself lives on only in the self-consciousness of the nostalgic narrative. Taylor, instead, tends to dream of moments drenched in self-consciousness, moments in which she knows how the future will go. And that fragility, that awareness of impending change, is something Taylor seems to find fascinating. But is this nostalgia? I don't know. Instead of answering that question, let's compare two of Taylor's songs, The Best Day and Seven. Both songs share a narrative about childhood as a time of curtailed knowledge and simple happiness, and both also feature trees. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read either one out loud in its entirety, but here's the first part of The Best Day. I'm 5 years old, it's getting cold, I've got my big coat on. I hear your laugh and look up smiling at you. I run and run past the pumpkin patch and the tractor rides. Look now, the sky is gold. I hug your legs and fall asleep on the way home. I don't know why all the trees change in the fall, but I know you're not scared of anything at all. Don't know if Snow White's house is near or far away, but I know I had the best day with you today. Nostalgia, as Susan Stewart tells us, is the repetition that mourns the inauthenticity of all repetition. This song demonstrates Taylor's distance from her past self. She can speak naively about not knowing why the leaves fall from the trees, but as she speaks, she knows that what she says will be interpreted as being about and postdating the knowledge that she eventually gains. When she says, I don't know, what she means is, I do know, I know now. What the song does is say over and over, that's not who I am anymore. I've changed and time has passed. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. After all, when was the best day? It seems to come at 5 and 13 and maybe at 3, and this is the implication at the end of the song, right now, I had the best day with you today. In other words, although the superlative best makes one think at first that Taylor is talking about a singular occurrence, out of all good days that one was the best, the song in fact reveals that the superlative in the phrase the best day is just for emphasis. In fact, it just means that was a really good day. Today, too, is the best day. Whereas Seven, on the other hand, actually posits that Taylor or her speaker hit her peak at seven. So Seven begins with Taylor singing, please picture me in the trees, I hit my peak at seven. Feet in the swing over the creek, I was too scared to jump in. But I was high in the sky with Pennsylvania under me. Are there still beautiful things? There's a moment on a swing when you reach the highest point and seem to freeze or pause in midair, gravity seemingly suspended. That was for Taylor, the age of seven. The inescapable text lurking within or next to this song is Robert Frost's Birches, a poem that imagines a boy climbing birches as a complicated metaphor for both the joy and the destructiveness of youth. He flung outward, feet first, with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. Frost's speaker wishes that he could get away from Earth a while, as he says, and then come back to it and begin over. Of course, swinging on a birch is an image or metaphor for trying to get away from Earth, all the while remaining attached to the Earth and its gravitational field, and in fact permanently harming its vegetation. As Frost points out of the imagined birch-swinging boy, one by one he subdued his father's trees by rinding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. As we say in academia, yikes. The natural world in which the speaker of birches reminisces about his childhood is the victim of those childhood impulses to ascend, to go high into the sky, as Taylor puts it. Nostalgia is just what ecological destruction feels like in retrospect. There might not be as much obvious damage in Taylor's Seven, but Seven hides within its pastoral, idyllic trappings a story of an unhappy home. So the speaker says, I've been meaning to tell you, I think your house is haunted. Your dad is always mad, and that must be why. Haunted. The word that for Taylor signals emotional damage, the past usurping the present. In this case, the damage seems to a child like a literal ghost. Here too, as in The Best Day, Taylor attempts to speak as or through a child, like a ghost possessing a child. This communication feels at once authentic and inauthentic. Understandable as the partial knowledge of a child trying to describe a friend's unhappy home life, and an adult imagining how such a situation might look to a child. Even the pastoral setting is a metaphor for, or maybe an instantiation of, a desire to return to simplicity. For Susan Stewart talks specifically about nostalgia as being tied to a desire for nature, for natural environments which are imagined as being in some way original, innocent. Quote, "The prevailing motif of nostalgia is the erasure of the gap between nature and culture. The nostalgic's utopia is prelapsarian." And indeed, Taylor imagines her peak as coming before she learned civility, when she was in the trees or the weeds later in the song. Prelapsarian means coming before a fall, the fall into civilization that is also the fall back towards the ground after you reach the peak of your progress upward on a swing, or for that matter, a birch. And in fact, the song is about a forgotten person, someone for whom Taylor feels love but whose face she can't remember, a blurry absence presence living in a haunted house. "Though I can't recall your face," she says, "I still got love for you. Love for an absent forgotten being whose face you can't even remember." Now, that's nostalgia, right? Without answering that question either, let me add one more thing to an already overlong episode. Wildest Dreams, a song about anticipated nostalgia that asks a lover to remember her in his wildest dreams when she is gone, caused some trouble for Taylor with its music video, which featured a relationship between two white, seemingly American actors visiting Africa to film a movie. The director claimed that the video was not about colonialism, but about a love story on the set of a period film crew in Africa, 1950. And indeed, I'm sure the video was not intended as a commentary on colonialism, but we're not getting hung up on intention, as discussed in episode 1. So what does it mean then to juxtapose the anticipation of leaving someone with a lot to look back on fondly with visual references to colonial Africa? What are we to make of the video's dabbling in history, its historicity, its, what were we calling it? Omnipresent and indiscriminate appetite for dead styles and fashions? After all, as Frederick Jameson reminds us, the 50s weren't the set of things we lump together and call the 50s now. We choose the past we represent. This is a salutary reminder, if we even needed one, that nostalgia, whatever it may be, is not entirely positive. Colonialism depends on the telling of false narratives, fabulation that seeks to exert power over the world and other people. In fact, it's an inherently nostalgic enterprise. As Dodman argues in the book I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, What Nostalgia Was, War, Empire, and the Time of a Deadly Emotion, nostalgia became established precisely during and in response to periods of European colonialism. It is necessary to take responsibility for nostalgia because it's through stories about the past that we jointly imagine a future. As Boehm puts it, nostalgia charts space on time and time on space and hinders the distinction between subject and object. It is Janus-faced, like a double-edged sword. To unearth the fragments of nostalgia, one needs a dual archaeology of memory and of place, and a dual history of illusions and of actual practices. I think that in some ways, you could see the video as a reflection on nostalgia itself and its connections to colonialism. Wild dreams can be nightmares. I'm reminded of James Joyce's Stephen Dedalus' claim that history is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake, which puts the song's injunction to remember me in your wildest dreams into a different perspective. But I don't know that it carries out the dual archaeology of illusions and actual practices that Boehm describes. What do you think? Thanks for listening to Studies in Taylor Swift, episode 4, Taylor Swift and Nostalgia. I'm going to have to take a week off next week, but for episode 5, please write in if you have any thoughts on this question. Does Taylor Swift have a style? And if so, what defines it?